Welcome to the MindWorks podcast with Dre and Kev. Today, we're actually back. We have a special guest. We are here with Michael Furketic today. Michael Furketic, you live in California, correct?
I live in Irvine. Yep, correct.
Nice. Irvine, California. Nice to see you. So basically, we're having this discussion from me and Kev. We're here in the East Coast. You're over there on the West Coast. The main point of today's discussion is to basically talk about Michael, about his upcoming book. He basically has a book called Definition of Free Will. Michael found me through one of our YouTube shorts, and he was one of a person that commented on one of our videos where we were discussing free will and determinism. And basically, we kind of started talking. He asked me a question, and we started talking from there, and he told me about his book. He sent over his book, The Definition of Free Will and the Model of Attention, which I found very interesting because, you know, when we talk about free will, we talk about usually it's aligned with the ideas of determinism. And, Mike's take on it is interesting because he says that let's move away from the ideas of free will versus determinism. And now here we are. And I'm going to ask Michael to introduce yourself and sort of talk about what your book is about and just to introduce yourself a little bit, a little background about yourself.
All right. Well, I grew up in Newport Beach, and I went to University of California, Irvine, got a bachelor's in biology. And back in 2003, while I was in college, I wrote a book called The Definition of Free Will, a Biophilosophic Viewpoint. And it had the same main thesis as this current book. But when I was kind of, after I got it published and I was going, you know, just kind of introspecting and reviewing, I thought that I could do a lot better. And so I kind of tabled any further discussion on the book, decided to kind of develop and expand out. And over the past 20 years, I've developed kind of on from my own thoughts and research, a new model of attention that better helps explain the concept of free will that I have. So it's an expanded out version of a model of attention centered around how to explain what free will is. And, the whole free will, it's a centuries old debate. You know, it's one of the existential questions, along with, are we alone in the universe? What happens when we die? Why is there something instead of nothing? Do we have free will? So it's an unresolved quandary I put in the book. It is the most irresolvable clash in philosophy. And the discussion inevitably, I mean, if you look at any YouTube channel and see the discussion, there's it's an impasse and there's stalemates of entrenched positions. So the contemporary discussion on free will doesn't include attention in that context, with an exception of Ayn Rand is the only person that I've come across. And also Michael Posner does touch on the topic of voluntary action in his model. And there's some parallels with his model, although my model's I try to be a little bit more comprehensive and broad in the framework. So I get into the book a little bit on explaining that. So the way free will is usually described is contextually vague and abstract and is often reduced just to the ability to choose, you know, between A or B. Can we make decisions? Can we not make decisions? So no one really offers a very specific description or definition saying exactly what free will is, the mechanics, the mechanism, with clarity and detail. So there's no like accepted definition of free will. Similarly with attention, the research and the work done in psychology and neurobiology and, you know, cognitive science describes what I see as different aspects of attention, like bits and pieces. The way I see it, it's not a comprehensive, holistic framework. The empirical research being done mainly focuses on external attention, like the external field, what I will get into, but a large portion of what occurs with our attention is happening internally in the internal field of attention. And it's really hard to gather empirical data and do experiments on the internal field of attention because there's no observational, you know, you kind of have to ask people what's going on inside of their minds, and that, you know, becomes extremely difficult in an experimental setting.
Yeah.
So the way I looked at it is, in order to properly clarify and describe the mechanism of free will and its connection with attention, I had to create a new model of attention, which involved a lot of introspection and kind of observing the way that my mind worked with intense focus.
Mind work. Mind works.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mind works podcast. There you go.
The best way to understand how the mind works is through self-exploration. You know, we can run these experiments on ourselves. So, you know, I think the current models of attention and research surrounding this topic can integrate really well with this new model. And there's a lot of parallels. So each theory is like I said, a bit bits and pieces.
I want to know, I'm sorry to cut you off. I just want to know, like, you know, you mentioned you're a biology, you are a biology major, you know, and it's interesting because I feel like a lot more biologists would argue that, like, you know, I know you're presenting a model of attention, but wouldn't a biologist kind of argue that the model of attention is stimulated by our biological brain itself, which is a different separate mechanism from our own conscious awareness?
Right. So that is the deterministic position. You know, everything that occurs in this universe is a cause and effect. It's a causal chain of events that can be traced all the way back to the Big Bang. And, you know, that's where the impasse kind of occurs in this debate, where there's no way around. You know, you can't disprove that either way. So, you know, it's one of these things where the book is meant to kind of sidestep that whole debate. There's no question, no one debates that we have the at least illusion of free will. We have this idea that we are free agents and can make our own choices. So that's not a topic of debate. So, you know, my approach is more pragmatic in that, okay, let's say it is an illusion. Let's go in and dig in and identify what this illusion is. What is the mechanism? What are the mechanics? And how do we decipher what is free will? Because, you know, to me, the ability to make a choice, you know, regardless of any internal or external cues, that's a description of free will, but it didn't cut it for me in terms of like what it is, you know? It's a theoretical, it's not, the model isn't meant to be a definitive empirical account. It's meant to be conceptual, to understand what free will is, and then hopefully inspire future research, you know, and based on it. So, you know, I also did want to balance the academic, like intellectual approach with the ability for the layperson to understand the model, you know, so that they can also take value in the material. So that's why I do bring up literature and a little bit of technical experimental research, but it's kind of slightly wedged in, not too much, you know, so it doesn't overwhelm people and the common vocabulary.
So I guess, like, in terms of like the whole idea of the model of attention, like what is the model of attention in your perspective? Like what does it mean? What is it? Can you give us like a little bit of a breakdown as to what you mean of the model of attention? Because does that have to deal with, like, you know, in psychology, we know about things like related, like sensation and perception, and how, I guess, like, you know, sensation is definitely the things that you know, experience, and you kind of sense things. I guess even through your vision, you kind of have like this attention field or whatever the case is. Is any of that model of attention related to anything in line with like sensation and perception or any ideas of it?
Right. So to begin, I think of attention as a field. much like a field of vision, but, you know, just using that as a conceptual parallel, but attention is a field with a focal point and a periphery. So if you kind of think about the field of vision, you know, you have something that you're focusing on, and then you have the surrounding periphery. So we have an internal field of attention, or an external field of attention, I should say, which is obviously our interaction with the environment, the sensory environment. And then we also, you know, an internal field of attention, which is basically, you know, inside of our mind. So a mental attention. Each field has its own focal point and periphery. You know, my definition of a focus is just concentrated awareness. So attention to me is the kind of totality of the our conscious awareness. Everything that we're aware of is in our field of attention, and what we are focusing on is where in that field we are concentrating our awareness. You know, just in your field of vision, you know, you have something that you're focusing on, perhaps me on the screen, and that is where you're concentrating your awareness.
Is that where you argue that this is the free will right there, and that focal of attention point, like the fact that we can utilize our sort of like way to look at something and kind of like see it? And is that where we have that control of like a will or free will?
Yes, exactly. Yes. So one of the concepts, the main concept, the thesis is the definition of free will is the ability to control the focus of your attention. So there's obviously some nuance there, and there's some further explanation that is required.
So when you're saying that, what I'm thinking of is people that suffer with like ADHD, for example, right? Mm-hmm. Like somebody that has issues with attention. You know, when I work with people as a mental health counselor, with people that have ADHD, you know, it's kind of interesting because it's like they say things along the lines like, you know, I really try to focus, but for some reason I just can't, you know. And it's like, you know, how much of that is equivalent to what you're saying in terms of the focal point and them being able to like be able to focus and whatnot. I'm wondering if, like, you know, just to dig deeper into this is like, sorry, I said diaper because I'm, you know, I was just changing diapers all night last night about my daughter and stuff. But anyway, so to dig a little deeper into this, my thing is that I wonder, like, you know, are we kind of like born with like a percentage of focus that we can elicit in our environments? Because it's an interesting thing, because when you talk with people with ADHD, they kind of always explain this thing where, well, I'm not interested in it. And like, I don't know if I can be interested in something. And then as a therapist, you know, using cognitive behavioral therapy, I try to really tell the client, like, look, like maybe you can focus if you reframe what it is that you're telling yourself about the things that you are or not interested in. So it's not like, so let's say, for example, I have a student who's like, comes to me, a 16-year-old that says, hey, Andre, I'm really struggling in math, right? And I ask them, well, what do you think about math? And it's like, well, I hate it and I don't like the teacher. So then, you know, to me, that's an indication that like, okay, so your bias and your preferences is what's shaping, I guess, if I were to use your orientation, your focal point of external attention, you know, like that's what's affecting, you know. So I guess it's interesting to say the internal and external focus points that we have control over. But then for some people, it's obviously not evident. And some people struggle with trying to have that focus internally and externally still, even if they try as hard as possible to reframe what they think about that specific thing. So I'll tell a client, oh, start, instead of saying that you hate math, start saying that you can like math. It's a likable thing. Start thinking in that way. And then I think, can that be another avenue within the external and internal focus of attention? Like maybe behind that, there's a bigger window of like cognitive biases and beliefs and preferences and whatnot that I think a person can try to reframe and control. I mean, does that sound clear?
Oh yeah, sure. Yeah. And you know, there's a subconscious suggestion mechanism at play there in the internal field, which is, you know, something that I call impressive attention, but I'll get to that. But
impressive attention.
Right. Okay. So there's a difference between impressive and expressive attention. And then free will is the domain of expressive attention. But I will say that focal energy is a limited resource. And there's a whole section in the book. The last section is called Free Will Isn't Free, right? So it's a metaphorical parallel. And it's true because focal energy that we have is closely tied to currency. I mean, it's closely tied to monetary currency. And so that's why when, you know, you say you're paying attention to somebody, you know, you're choosing to spend focal energy on, you know, whatever source it is. So right. So that's an
interesting one, because monetary currency, and you're saying that the attention is a thing that you're exchanging or using to get something.
Well, right. So in order to sustain focus on something, or when you direct your focus on an aspect of your environment or internally, it requires focal energy.
When you say monetary, like what did you mean by that exactly? I might have just misunderstood.
So it's a limited resource. You know, that we have to spend, and at any given moment, we have a certain amount of focal energy that we could spend. And in the book, one of the main concepts is, well, I'll get to that, but the just like gold used to back our monetary currency, I draw the parallel that motivation is the currency that backs the focal energy. You know, in order to sustain focus for long periods of time, it requires.
So you said, I'm sorry to cut you off. You said motivation?
Motivation, right.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So this motivation can either be generated internally through the subconscious, kind of feeding us suggestions that are imbued with inherent motivation. But then if we are wanting to accomplish a task and we just don't have the motivation to expend our focal energy towards it, we have to consciously generate that motivation in, you know, extrinsically. So that, you know, that could be a practice teaching people to generate their own motive when they're not getting motivation from their mind and their subconscious. They have to focus their attention on generating motivation to achieve the goal or task that they want.
So basically we left off talking a little bit about motivation, right? And you're talking about how motivation can either be generated internally through the subconscious, mm-hmm. and how that's a factor in terms of, I guess, how it affects the external field of attention.
Well,
that's what you left off talking about.
Right. So that would affect more of the internal field of attention, you know, giving us internal motivation. But the concept of focal energy being, you know, having a parallel to monetary currency, attention has great value in our society, in our economy. You know, some people, you say, they just love getting the attention. You know, some people just love attention as much as they love money. So there's also, if you look at social media, there's a premium for attention where companies are competing for attention. When social media companies advertise on, when companies advertise on social media, they are basically paying for other people's attention. So, you know.
I like this concept. When you're saying this, Mike, what I'm thinking is time and energy is our resource, and we exchange our time and energy for something else, usually monetary, and then we exchange monetary dollars for something else. So you're saying that the time and energy is basically our number one asset that we have to focus on with. Is there something that comes after? Like, where should we be focusing on our time and energy?
Right, exactly. And kind of the overarching theme is understanding the mechanics of how your focus works so that you can basically program yourself and utilize and exercise free will with in a higher order manner. Just to kind of give a more broad overview. So you have these internal and external fields of attention, and then, you know, they each have their own focus and periphery, but we have all of these channels that plug into each field of attention. So the channels that plug into the external field of attention are, you know, your visual channel, your auditory channel, your tactile, proprioception, you know, for body orientation, taste, and smell. So those are channels that deliver what I call signal inputs onto the field of attention. And so these signal inputs are like the raw data or the raw information that comes into our attention, or as I say, it's the mass or matter to the field of attention, which is the empty space. And so the internal channels of attention, it's a little bit less defined, but there are several that can be identified, like memories, thoughts, internal monologue, visual and auditory imagery. Like we can picture a red apple in our mind. That's an internal imagery channel. So you have all of these channels that are feeding in signal inputs into the field of attention. And so next is the concepts of impressive and expressive attention, or the impressive and expressive action. So action on the field describes the way that this information interacts with our focal energy. So impressive action would be things that catch or grab our attention. So free will isn't necessarily the ability to control what comes into our attention. It's the ability to direct and control the focus of attention amidst all of the information that's coming into it. So, you have impressive action, and, the classic one is a loud noise or hearing your name in a crowded room. Those are all examples of impressive attention or impressive action, and, on whichever field it's in. And so that grabs or draws the focus in towards it as a source. But then,
so I guess just to clarify the impressive action, basically the reason why you use that terminology is because obviously it's just like something in the environment that puts an impression onto you.
Exactly.
That's why it's an impressive action from the environment. So then you get impressed by the sort of thing that's happening in your environment. Now you're going into the external action, right? Or the, what was it? Well, expressive action.
Expressive
action, mm-hmm. Which means that now I'm impressed by this sound or whatever. Now I'm going to express something.
Right. So if you hear a loud noise, that is impressive action. It would be impressive action on your, the sound of the noise would be impressive action on the external field of attention through the auditory channel. And then I described there's a valve, and then that would, be filtered in and then become impressive action in the internal field of attention. And then you think, oh, loud noise. And then at that point, you can use your free will to investigate that noise, ignore that noise, but that's where the expressive action comes in, the ability to direct control of your focus to that noise or whatever channel you want.
That's a very interesting sort of thing to think about, because when you talk about emotion and thought, they always kind of argue in the field of psychology, like what comes first, like the emotional reaction or like the thought of what you're reacting to. What comes first, the emotion or the thought, basically, of what's happening? Make sense?
Yeah,
I think that goes into like James Lange theory of emotion and thought.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm not 100% on that one. There's some nuance there, but I forgot to mention one of the main functions or factors that plays a role in the internal field of attention is what I call a subconscious suggestion mechanism. And so the reason I use the term suggestion is because it's very akin to or the same as hypnotic suggestion. So, our subconscious has us constantly in a low-level, pervasive, persistent, but low-level trance that we are constantly in, where it's constantly imbuing suggestions into our internal field of attention. And so, we're constantly being fed information from our subconscious. I mean, there's obvious survival advantages there, and it helps us automate tasks. But then, there can be imbalanced and maladjusted and biased subconscious suggestions.
Well, that's implicit biases, right? Like anything that you sort of think, there's an implicit bias that needs to be recognized sometimes. So in a way, just to clarify, you're kind of going into the realm of like, I guess, psychoanalysis, if we're talking like therapy or like, you know, just an intervention to go into the unconscious mind and figure out what things are. And typically, I think there was a recent research study that did show that like our subconscious mind or unconscious mind holds way more information than our conscious mind does. And a lot of people believe that that's what drives us. It's a lot of our unconscious experiences that we're not fully aware of typically consciously.
The subconscious exists in how I see it behind the veil of awareness. So where it's a vast repository for memories, emotions, experiences, you know, everything that you've ever, you know, experienced, and it can draw on this knowledge. It can even generate and synthesize new knowledge, but it has such a profound effect, and it has to be mentioned whenever you're talking about attention, because the subconscious suggestion mechanism is constantly feeding us with these suggestions, which are impressive action on our internal field. You know, in the same way that you hear a loud noise, and it's an impressive action on the external field, but this is, you know, obviously a little bit different with the subconscious. Yeah. And
it's interesting because a lot of psychologists, you know, who believe in all the psychoanalytic stuff would argue that a lot of those subconscious things are what drives us, which then hinders our free will, you know, because then it's like, you know, you're born into this world with all these experiences, and then these experiences shape who you are, kind of. So do you then have a free will in that regard? And then people will argue the concept of what they call psychic determinism, which is basically that idea that a lot of our unconscious mind is kind of driven by these things that we've learned through our life experiences.
Right. Yeah. And there's a section in the book, and it's called the passive versus active application of free will. So most of the time,
I like this. You have a response to everything that that is like deterministic, which is good.
And it's all in the book.
And it's all in the book too. So go get this book, everybody. But it's definitely interesting to hear you say that, like everything. So what is it that you called it again?
The passive versus active application of free will. And so it in no way takes away from your capacity for free will. I mean, it's always there, but a passive application of free will is the basic on autopilot. And basically when you tell your subconscious, I'm going to trust your judgment, I'll go ahead and do what you're saying, or, you know, think what you're telling me to think about. There for every subconscious suggestion that gets fed into the internal attention, there's two qualities that I've been able to identify. One, I call the strength of the suggestion, and that is the ability of the suggestion to capture our focus and draw a very concentrated focal energy towards it. And then the other quality is what I call the potency, which is the ability of that suggestion to compel you into action, either compelling you to remain focused on that suggestion or compel you into action.
What do you think about that suggestion? Is it something along the lines of intuition?
I think, yeah, of course, yeah. And I think intuition is a type of suggestion where it comes into your focus, not clearly. It doesn't have a high strength. And we're not talking about compelling you to do anything, but it doesn't have a high strength, but you can kind of feel it. But you don't know exactly what why you're feeling, you know, to do something a certain way.
So it's interesting that you're using words like strength and potency, because then, like, I guess that could be in line with like intuition, like how strong a person's intuition is. Usually in personality psychology, psychologists try to like really understand a person's level of their intuition and their strength within that, you know, like, because some people are actually more intuitive than others, you know, and it's like a question is like, why has that happened? Why are some people more intuitive than others? And I think if you use your framework, it's an interesting thing to sort of like think about. And I think what your book presents is definitely a lot of ways to think about all the things in processing feelings, emotions, subconscious ideas and attention and all these type of things. It's it's very aligned in the like the field of psychology, I gotta say, you know. And like kind of just very psychological.
Right. Oh, yeah. And it's definitely meant to be, you know, various disciplines, of course. But I would say breathing is actually what I see as a continuous subconscious suggestion mechanism that obviously it's always going. But the act of breathing, it would have very low strength. It doesn't require any conscious focal energy being directed towards it, but it is extremely high potency, meaning it's very, there's a very high motivation to breathe.
To the body naturally, like maybe not on a psychologically conscious level, but through right. The central nervous system, right? And I think that's why they kind of call it the autonomic nervous system, because it kind of like does like an automatic sort of thing, right? Like I think that's probably why they call it that, like the autonomic nervous system, like your heart beating and whatnot. The same
right.
thing.
Right. And we always do have the ability to focus on our breath and kind of, you know, kind of direct it towards our breath. And I think that is why breath work may be such a powerful exercise, because you are in the practice of taking a subconscious suggestion mechanism and taking control over it, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, if you can apply that same method or ideology to something that is, you know, psychological or more cognitive, then, you know, then that can help you in those avenues as well. But it kind of gives us control that we have the ability to take over the helm of a subconscious automatic process.
So the strength of suggestion and then the potency of suggestion. So things like breathing, heartbeat, things that we don't really have control of would have a very weak suggestion mechanism, but then very high potency of suggestion. Is that clear?
Right. And I wouldn't say so much the heartbeat, but like I would say another thing is like
because we can't control our heartbeat, right? What are your thoughts about that then? Like something like within our bodies, like the mechanism with the heartbeat in terms of all these things that you're saying, because I don't think we could really control our heartbeat. However, our heart can be impacted by other conscious emotions such as mm-hmm. anger and frustration right. and stress mm-hmm. and things like that. Mm-hmm. So is that like another avenue within our own bodies that, you know, has some sort of will, you know? And I'm wondering, you know,
well, like it's through expressive action, you can calm your state of mind. You can kind of get in a position where you, if your heart is beating very fast, you can get it to slow down. So I guess there are ways to use your free will to have the effect on your heartbeat. You know, but
like also like your digestive system, you know, like how do you, like, can you control that? Which is interesting too.
Yeah. No, I use breathing just as an example, because we have the ability to take control over the focus of our breathing. But it is a constant process. It, you know, that
we also got the ability to take control of our bowel movements too. And stuff,
yeah,
right?
yeah. If you're lucky enough.
A lot of free will within that, thankfully.
yeah. But this is the subconscious suggesting mechanism comes into play for things like addiction as well, where there's a very high potency for those suggestions. It may not be high strength, like when craving occurs for someone who's addicted to drugs comes into their mind. It may not be a strong, clear, vivid, concentrated focus as being the crave, but it's very highly motivated, highly compelling. You know, they're motivated, you know, towards, you know, using the drug. So I think there's areas where, you know, using the model can help with that field.
But yeah, like as you're talking, I'm realizing that I feel like I could use, this is like a lot of like wordplay and idea that I can use in like, you know, sessions with people and understanding. And I think it has a applicability or a potential to be applicable in the field of psychology, which will be interesting to see how far your work actually goes with these ideas and these concepts. And it must have been very creative. I'm kind of curious to know, where did you get these ideas from and how did you like create them? What was your creative process, I guess?
I mean, it just basically dedicated, concentrated focus internally saying what is going on in my mind right now, and just very meticulously and granularly breaking it down. Over a period of 20 years, you know, that's how all this came to me. It's not like I understood this overnight, but just kind of like examining my experience, my experiential awareness, and how things change and move and what's going on. And then really coming up with language that can submit those ideas into words that, you know, can be expressed and for people to understand them.
So Michael, so this book I haven't read it yet, but I'm sure when I read it, I'll enjoy it. Who is your target audience? Like, is this book for the folks who like the personal development type of books, psychology type of books? Is this for researchers? Who is your target audience? And also, what is the end goal for those folks who you're inviting to read your work?
I would say the main target audience is for people that want to have an awareness of their own mind to improve and better themselves, which would be the public at large generally. But I have to strike a balance because it has to appeal and it has to be accepted and kind of mingle well with the scientific disciplines, you know? So, you know, and I do recognize and acknowledge the parallels and the inputs and the contributions of empirical research in the field. You know, but mainly the purpose of the book is to help people improve their life, you know, to help people, you know, through understanding this power that they have, the ability to control the focus of your attention. There, I mean, what is said simply has, you know, very complex meaning, you know, but, you know, the ability to control the focus of your attention can take you, you know, to far places. You know, mentally, when you're looking at cognitive ability, emotional stability, decision-making, you know, introspecting, metacognition, being able to analyze what's going on in your own mind. Once you have those abilities through an awareness of them, then I think it follows that you're generally, you know, in a position to endeavor in more fruitful accomplishment, you know? Mm-hmm. So... I would say it is for the general audience, the general public. So, you know, it's difficult, you know, introducing these terms and having to clarify them and help people understand them when I'm, you know, introducing them for the first time myself. So there's a balance there, but I think, you know, through going through the editorial process several times and cleaning it up and, you know, the making sure that the language is cohesive and, you know, comprehensible, I think it'll follow for people that with a genuine interest in understanding this, they'll be able to understand, you know, the way it all works.
Is it? Yeah. Anyone?
So with the adaptation of AI in recent years, how do you think that would influence free will? I guess in general, can an AI, I guess my question is, can we get to a level of AI that has that same, I guess, structure that you bring to the table with free will? Do you think AI will ever get to that point?
Ooh, that's a good one. I'm going to have to think about that.
So basically, would AI be able to be like sentient and like, and so...
if we can describe that it has some form of attention, and then we know that we can feed it data and then it will respond, I think if we can, if AI can express its own form of attention, however that's described, I guess then you can say that it has a form of sentience or at least agency. that's a good question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agency, a little bit of willpower and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Is there any, because we went through a lot of different terminologies just in this discussion so far with an impressive expressive action, mm-hmm. You know, the whole passive versus active application and strength of suggestion and potency of suggestion. Mm-hmm. Is there any other interesting terminology that you have from your book that is associated with any of this stuff?
Yeah, so I also want to say willpower. So the definition of willpower, in the way I use it, is the ability to exert control and direct focus in a manner that you see fit in spite of internal impressive action, right? So we have these, well, I guess, external and internal influences that are compelled, you know, drawing our attention, capturing our focus, and then also compelling us and imbuing us with motivation to act in a certain way. Where willpower comes in is it is the ability to, you know, to reframe, refocus, override, you know, and kind of take all of those influences in a different direction. You know, so there's this whole section in the book about willpower where it's actually, it's a parallel to how you would describe power in physics. It's called power equals work over time. So that's kind of a parallel there on how willpower can be used to identify and recognize these impressive actions on the internal field of attention and then do otherwise. In terms of your willpower.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because many psychologists in the field argue, like almost like a bunch of them argue against the terminology of willpower. They argue that it's all about, it's more the better definition of willpower is self-control.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, like the word self-control.
Yeah, self-control. Like, really, yeah. It's all about control. I mean, free will is the ability to control the focus of your attention. The other main concept that I wanted to focus on and how it all really comes together is in what I call like a focal energy distribution pattern. And that's where, like, at any given moment, you know, people say like you can't really divide your attention and, you know, you can only focus on one thing at a time. But, you know, you have a certain amount of focal energy that you can distribute amongst the different channels at any given point. So if you think about it right now, you have some of your, if you wanted to look at the focal energy distribution pattern, some of your focus is directed on the external field visually, to see me, you know, and then externally on the auditory channel to hear me. And then also you have focus distributed internally to comprehend what I'm saying, you know, the language and the message of the words. And then you also have focus internally generating your own responses and your own thoughts that are also coming into your attention. So you have for any given moment, you have a certain focal energy distribution pattern, which describes how much focus is being distributed to each one of these channels, you know, and there's a certain intensity or amount of focus being put into one, into each channel. Like if you're looking and if you're concentrating on something very hard, you're concentrating all of your available focal currency or focal energy into that one channel. And then at that point, it's very difficult to focus on anything else because your available resources are being directed towards one channel. And so you're concentrating all of your available energy or awareness into one channel. And that's why we say we're concentrating on something, you know?
Like so basically it's interesting that you're saying all that, because if I were to work with a client in therapy and they were talking about having to get tasks done and they tell me something along the lines, like I'll ask them like, do you multitask a lot? And they'll say like, yeah, I'm capable of doing that. But research in the field of psychology shows that we're not capable of multitasking to our fullest potential in certain things. Like, for example, this is why there's laws like texting and driving and whatnot, or talking on the phone and driving, because we know through research that we're not able to really multitask in those ways. But if I were to use your terminology and whatnot, I would say the expressive, the expressive attention or the expressive action?
Action. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
The expressive action, it depends on the strength of the expressive action, because I can literally multitask by listening to music and cleaning my room, and I feel like I do a way better job in that sort of multitasking thing. So the expressive action, or is it the expressive action, the thing in the environment? So the expressive action,
The expressive act, you would be in, that's a great example, cleaning your room while listening to music. You would be,
the potency is not so high, though. The strength of that expressive action is not so high. Like I can do that. But I wouldn't be able to like clean my room and read a book.
Right. Yeah. Or clean your room. And it might be a little bit more difficult to clean your room and try to pick the drum track out of the song that you're listening to, because, you know, you can in that focal energy distribution pattern, most of your focus would be generated, you know, sourced towards the kinesthetic, you know, channel to clean your room. And this is also where having the subconscious comes in helping with these automated processes.
So your terminology, if I were to talk to a client and I were to define these things, I would say the expressive attention, right? Or expressive action.
Action.
So I would say it's dependent on your expressive actions within your environment.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
That's the stuff coming from the environment, right? So just for example, expressive action would be the music coming from the environment. That's the expressive action.
No, the other way around. The impressive action is that which is impressed upon us.
Oh yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Yes, mm-hmm. The impressive action would be the music coming from the environment. My expressive action, I have to be able to figure out my sort of levels of my own expressive action to take on this task plus this task. Because I feel like some people are really good at multitasking, and I don't know how. And research studies are saying, like, you can't do this. Like, for example, I'm also a teacher in psychology, and some students tell me that they are capable of reading a book and listening to music at the same time, understanding the book. And to me, I'm just like, I can never do that. Like, I don't know how you can read a book and listen to music with lyrics even and still understand what you're reading. To me, that's complicated.
Right. So I guess in that people that can do that have the ability to kind of sequester only a small amount of vocal energy towards the music, but maintain the camera's going to focus here in a second, but
yeah.
maintain the main amount of vocal energy is distributed towards reading the book.
So using that sort of these words is interesting. So the impressive action is coming from the environment. The expressive action is coming from the individual. So right. I guess it's a measurement. So then maybe one day if a researcher takes your terminology and wants to measure the ideas of expressive action, mm-hmm. then they will probably try to figure out a way to a scaling system or something that can measure that to some degree by objectively using more like the behavioral realm and observing and using empirical research to see somebody's levels of attention and see what level is their expressive action at. Are they capable of multitasking this much? I also feel that in today's generation with our youth, they are being trained to multitask in many different ways through these iPads and these technologies that we have. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering, you know, the next question is like how significant or how, you know, even probably dangerous, is it dangerous or is it a positive thing in how their minds are sort of working through all this technology, you know, and like, is it something good? Is it enhancing their expressive action or not, basically, if we're using your terminology?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, there's a difference between task shifting, you know, task switching, you know, and multitasking, yeah. You know, I think task switching is probably a lot easier, but I guess it depends on how you would define multitasking, because if you're watching, watching a movie is a good example of even distribution of focal attention towards the visual and auditory channels. So I guess in one way, you could say watching a movie is multitasking if you're watching it and listening to it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So in the,
interesting.
Yeah. So I guess it's a little bit context dependent to that effect.
Yeah.
But the in the book, there's a complete breakdown of focal attention and in the distribution pattern for the example I say of if you're scrolling through social media while having a conversation with a friend, you know. So, I mean, if you can picture that, if you're scrolling through your phone on social media while having a conversation with your friend, it captures a very, you know, broad distribution pattern. A lot of channels being engaged, you know, your visual channel to look at the post, your auditory channel to hear the person, you know, your kinesthetic channel to speak to them. And then you got to understand the post and understand what they're saying. So if you see a post, in that way, if you see a post that looks more interesting, you can decide to kind of shift that pattern to be more concentrated towards the post, And then once you're done with it, you shift back to listening to your friend, you know? So just kind of free will in a more technical sense in that scenario is the ability to control that focal energy distribution across those different channels, but apply that to a universal setting, right? So to me, the grandest exposition of free will is expressive action on the internal field of attention, because, you know, the range of the internal field is infinite with the, you know, infinite possibility of thought. So expressive action on the internal field is unlimited, right? It's unbound conscious creative thought. And to me, that is the grandest ability of consciousness on the planet, is that pure, unbridled ability to generate thought, or, you know, or focus your attention on anything in the universe that you want, regardless of any internal or external cues. And I know a lot of determinists will, you know, say, well, whatever you think about, it was the result of the subconscious, you know, feeding you a suggestion, so that, you know, if you try to think about something random, there was something in your subconscious mind that determined that. But, you know,
that's for debate.
Yeah, that's all based on physics, but you don't find emotions or dreams or thoughts in physics. So I think looking at free will from, you know, the view of physics, it's like, why can't we find free will in physics? Because we're looking in the wrong place, you know?
Yeah, I see what you mean. All right. So I guess, you know, we can, you know, we're going to have to, I guess, cut it a little short here for today. But I think we talked about many different things. Basically, the whole discussion was based around the idea of free will. You know, you gave us a lot of different information. I hope you people at home that are listening to the podcast really take everything that we talked about and maybe consider it. And also, I guess, Mike, if you could let the audience know where they can find your book, and I know you're in the process of being published, where they can find you if they're interested in reaching out to you and learning more about your book and all the things that we talked about today, to let them know.
Yeah, sure. So the book is currently in an editorial review. I'm looking at different publishers right now. I would expect it to be ready to go in the next month or so for publication. But as for now, you can reach me on my email address is mikeforkettick73@gmail.com. And, you know, I'm also happy to answer any questions in the comments section and any inquiries therein, you know, always have people understand.
We'll post your information in the comment section as well in the description below. And for those at home, yeah, leave a comment, leave an idea, whatever you think about free will. We're also going to be cutting up little reels just so we can get a little taste of today's episode and what it was today, like little highlight reels. So we'll be doing that, all right?
Thank you
for tuning in, everybody. Thanks, Michael, so much for allowing us to speak on this. We'll definitely keep in touch. I want to see when your book comes out. Let me know. I'll definitely be interested in seeing what you come up with.
Thank you, Andre. I really appreciate you having me on. Thank you. It means a lot.
No problem. All right. No problem. All right. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye. Peace.
Take care.